Hello, fellow foodies. Have you ever found yourself in the unfortunate position of having to toss some food from the fridge that's lingered too long and gone bad? Or how about food scraps or unconsumed leftovers from your plate after a meal? Food waste is a major issue in America, as well as across the globe. And guess what? It doesn't just happen in your home kitchen. It happens in the fields, where not all foods are harvested, or on the shipping lines, where only the prettiest produce is selected for resale. It happens in school campuses, from elementary to universities. And what is most shocking is that even while 1 in 6 American children live in a state of food insecurity, not knowing where their next meal will come from, there's still an estimated 30 to 50% of the U.S. food supply that is being wasted. So in this episode, I wanted to explore the issue of ethical and healthy eating. At Emory University, we've been working on this for 15 years in the Sustainable Food Initiative. I'm going to speak with Dr. Peggy Barlett. She's a Goodrich White Professor of Anthropology at Emory University, and she specializes in agricultural anthropology and sustainability in higher education. As faculty liaison to the Office of Sustainability at Emory, she has coordinated the Sustainable Food Initiative and led workshops on curriculum development for over 600 campus leaders around the country. She was the co-editor of Sustainability on Campus, Stories and Strategies for Change, published in 2004, and in Sustainability in Higher Education, Stories and Strategies for Transformation, that was published in 2013. Dr. Barlett is also the author of an award-winning study of the U.S. farm crisis of the 1980s. She has served on the National Research Council Board on Agricultural and Natural Resources and was elected president of the Society for Economic Anthropology. She's worked with groups in Atlanta and across the nation to support the transformation of American culture towards a more sustainable society. I'm so excited to learn more from Dr. Barlett about how sustainability initiatives can be used to reduce this tragic trend of unethical food use in the U.S. and beyond. And it's such a pleasure to have you here, Peggy. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. It's so funny. As I was mentioning before we started recording, I actually took your anthropology course back in the early 90s. And I remember how much I enjoyed that class. And in fact, it was one of the courses that really brought me to decide to do a major in anthropology. So
that's so wonderful to hear.
That's great.
Thank you.
Well, I want to start off our conversation with just some basic information around sustainability. Is our current conventional food system sustainable, and why or why not?
Well, that's really an important place to start. I think all of us grew up paying attention to how much we pay for our food. What's a good bargain? Can you get the bananas cheaper here or there? Mm-hmm. You know, is it smart to get a canned tomato or a fresh tomato? But we really never thought about the environmental costs of that food system. And in the last decade or two, more and more of us have become aware that actually, if we continue to grow food the way we're growing it, we're going to have major problems in the future. The head of the National Soil Association told me that if we continue to grow food the way we're growing it, there will be no topsoil left in Iowa in 100 years.
Wow.
Now, Iowa, you know, is the richest topsoil in the world, and we've already eroded away half of it. And apparently, these heavy rains that are coming now because of the change in weather structures have really messed up the soil conservation strategies that have been put in place. So we're seeing soil problems. We're also seeing, of course, chemical contamination. We're seeing more fish being deformed because of the chemicals that come off of fields and feedlots. And we're seeing the dead zones. So we're seeing ocean and waterways being contaminated, sometimes by nutrients, sometimes by chemicals. And we've got dead zones not only at the mouth of the Mississippi that's supposed to be the size of the state of New Jersey, but we also have dead zones in 300 other mouths of rivers around the world. And the idea that this incredible rich resource of the ocean with so many thousands of species is completely dead as a result of what humans are doing on the land that drains into it, we just can't keep going on expanding those dead zones.
Yeah.
So I really was so pleased because of my concern, both about the economic pressures on farmers. I'm very loyal to the farmers that I have studied over the years, both in Latin America and in the U.S., and also these environmental problems, that when Emory began to take stock of sustainability 15 years ago and decide some goals for our first 10 years, we included goals around food. And part of that was those long-term issues around agriculture, but part of it was also health. Mm-hmm. We had two physicians on the strategic planning committee, and they felt strongly that the obesity epidemic and the way in which health measures were showing decline rather than improvement in so many ways around the country really argued for a need to change our diet.
Yeah. Well, going back to this idea of land use patterns, what caught my attention in the linkages to dead zones and the loss of soil quality, as someone that studied traditional agricultural systems, is this sort of monocropping typical in human history, or is this something relatively new? And is this one of the reasons that we're starting to see these changes?
Oh, I love that you have an anthropological, historical view of it. Yes, this is really what I call the advent of industrial agriculture. It comes with the beginning of using industrial products, manufactured fertilizers, chemicals, and particularly big machinery to replace the more sustainable plow agriculture that used the sun's energy primarily to grow food. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, we subsidize the sun with petroleum. And so we have a system that's kind of artificially productive, but it has a lot of high costs. And it's very – some of these environmental costs we were able to predict, like we knew when we started using certain seed varieties that they were going to be obsolete within a few years because they would create resistance. But other times we didn't know, and it took mm-hmm. time for us to realize the full scope of damage. I have a colleague who studies fish out in Wyoming, and he and his graduate students have found that fish downstream from the beef feedlots show all kinds of deformities and tumors and open sores. And then north or upstream from those feedlots, that isn't the case.
Yeah.
So we didn't even know that until we have had these kinds of projects.
Absolutely. I recently interviewed Maren McKenna, who's a journalist and author and expert on antibiotics and the use of antibiotics in our agricultural systems. And, you know, it's amazing how antibiotics have transformed the way that we do grow meat animals, because those concentrated feedlots would not be possible if we weren't dosing the animals with, you know, pharmaceuticals to prevent the massive spread of disease that you would see with such a concentration of creatures.
That's right. That's right. And it was very scary to me when I talked with a biologist who was working on the coast of Georgia, far from the chicken production mm-hmm. in the north where antibiotics are routinely used. But the antibiotic-resistant bacteria they find in those chickens is now in the seabirds on the coast.
Wow.
So these ecosystems spread mm-hmm. the problems, and sometimes we don't really know what's the future holds.
Yeah.
So we began here at Emory to begin to say, well, how can we contribute to a more sustainable future? And we really set a very bold goal of wanting to purchase the majority of our food from sustainable sources or local sources.
So this means that you're staying within seasonality if you're focusing on local sources as well.
That's right. And that's one of the ways we can do this and save money. Mm-hmm. So we really don't try to buy things out of season. We try to downplay things like strawberries in the winter. We try to get strawberries in the spring when they're fresh and mm-hmm. local in Georgia. And we, in fact, have a strawberry festival where we bring in organic grower and sell wonderful, delicious strawberries, and try not to get the cardboard strawberries shipped from California in the off season. And things like asparagus, other things that come a long distance, get flown in from far away. We try to really stick to the local, and that also often means it's more sustainably grown.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think also there's some interesting science around when you are eating something within season and it is, you know, not traversing such a long distance, the chemistry, the pharmacology of those food products are different. And what that translates to, of course, is the health impact is different. So not every tomato is the same. Not every strawberry is the same. One grown in season, you can taste the chemistry. You can taste that difference in flavor. And that translates to health benefits as well. Yeah.
That's important. Right. And then there's an economic and a social justice side, because often when we're buying local, we're buying more directly from the farmer. And that means that the dollar that I spend goes more, a higher percentage of it goes into the pocket of the farmer and the local economy. Mm-hmm. So we found when we did a survey of several thousand people at Emory to look at what might be our goals when we started, we found that people really prioritized eating locally. And a lot of their concern was that they wanted rural communities to thrive. And they know that if we buy things from local Georgia communities. But that's a real change, because Georgia has come to depend very heavily on other states to provide mm-hmm. our food. So we're kind of beginning a process of reversing that over-specialization of Georgia into a few crops like cotton, peanuts.
Yeah.
And bring back a whole lot of the other crops that used to provide good profits for farmers.
Yeah. Well, I've heard a bit about blueberries grown in Georgia, and I know these are some of like the best blueberries, but they're actually shipped to Europe, and then we're eating other lower quality blueberries locally in a lot of trade. So right. It's amazing how you can have something in your back door that is not even coming to consumers in some cases.
Well, and it is crazy sometimes what makes sense in the market. I know that, for instance, some of our Georgia pecans get shipped to Pennsylvania to be packed and then come back to us.
Really?
I mean, it's crazy stuff like this that really comes from a time when petroleum was very cheap and we didn't have any reason to conserve it. So the fact that we were shipping things around, it made a little bit of sense for the corporation involved. But if we really begin to pay attention to the energy embedded in our food, then we begin to make some decisions differently. Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that Walmart, among other groups, has started asking food corporations to track their energy intensity has led them to discover, oh, wow, when we bring orange juice from Florida, we have one cost. But when we bring it from Brazil, it's a really different cost.
Yeah.
And I think for me as a consumer, that makes me want to ask, do I want orange juice every day if I pay a price of bringing it from Brazil, or do I want to eat it only when it's available from Florida?
Mm. That's a really good point. And it also kind of dovetails into some of the social justice issues that you're really interested in, that you study in your research. Can you comment a little bit about that?
One of the ways that at Emory we have tried to contribute to a more socially just food system is by purchasing fair trade. And we're committed that all of our coffee and tea will be fair trade. But we also look at some of the other products. And especially in Florida, there is an amazing movement of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, and they have developed a fair food certification for tomatoes.
Hmm.
And sometimes tomatoes are available here in Atlanta with that certification, and that would count toward our goal of buying more sustainable food. And we know then that there are protections to those workers, that the pay that they get is higher than the standard, that it's been worked out through a council with the local workers, and that there's a grievance procedure so that if there are any abuses on the job, farm workers have a say in how those mm-hmm. get settled. So they, my understanding is the Fair Food Labeling Group is moving into green peppers and moving up the coast
okay.
from Florida, so that someday, I hope, that we can go into a grocery store and find fair labeling of some kind in all of our produce. And that would really allow us to make a choice.
Yeah, to make a really educated choice. That's great, in support of fair labor.
Right.
Properties. Yeah.
Right. Another thing that we see has to do with energy embedded in food, especially as we talk now about greenhouse gases. There's a lot of comment these days about how we should eat lower on the food chain, eat more plants.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for many of us, we're quite willing to eat plants. We just don't know good recipes, or we haven't gotten used to ways of cooking and eating, choosing plant-based diets.
I remember when I had my home economics course in middle school, we were taught basically the way that my grandmother's cookbooks were set up, which was you take a can of this. It's usually a can of cream of chicken soup, and you add in a can of green beans, and you mix it together, and you add some deep-fried onions that are from another can, and you put that in the oven. So I think there's been a breakdown historically in the U.S. of the transfer of knowledge of how to actually cook with fresh ingredients. I'll be honest, I didn't learn how to cook a proper meal until I was doing field research in Italy. And the women I was working with studying, you know, their plant traditions with were just horrified. Like they had to teach me how to make a proper meal. And I feel very fortunate for that. And I wish we had more of that in our schools today to really educate our children, or more opportunities at home. But it's difficult when you have, in many cases, families with multiple partners working, and there's not as much time at home to teach the next generation how to cook.
It's so important. And I really find cooking just a real therapy. Mm-hmm. I can come home at the end of a hard day and spend some time making a good meal, and it's just very satisfying and not at all a burden for me. But it's easy because I've been doing it all my life.
You have the knowledge, the working knowledge of how to do it.
And you're absolutely right. I went to the grocery store today looking for a vegetable brush. Mine is worn out and I can't find one. There's several places I've looked. I can't find them. And it occurred to me, that's because not so many people are brushing their vegetables. They aren't buying as many fresh vegetables. But actually, I think the number of people who are aware of the importance of cooking with fresh and local food is increasing greatly.
Absolutely.
And the number of farmers markets, I believe what I heard just last night is that in the state of Georgia, about 20 some years ago, there were 9 farmers markets, and today there are 150.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So there really are just an enormous increase in people buying directly from the farmer and getting that nutritious, fresh food. But I want to say a little bit more about the energy embedded in the food, because if it's coming from Georgia, or let alone from your own backyard, we know it's going to be low energy in terms of transportation and probably lower energy in terms of the inputs. There's been a lot of talk about whether we should avoid meat, avoid beef, a lot of concern that beef has a great deal of energy embedded, or it's a very inefficient form of calories. Well, we don't really eat meat for the calories. We eat it for the protein. But it is something that does take a lot of resources to produce. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I'm excited to learn is that grass-fed beef in particular, but also grass-fed pork, have some real benefits that need to be put into this calculation of whether or not we should be eating meat. Grass-fed animals have pretty much gone away from our conventional system. They're almost all of the animals that we eat from grocery store meat come from feedlots where they're fed corn and soybeans. But grass-fed animals develop a different ratio of fatty acids in the meat. And some researchers have argued that this ratio is better for the human body. It's more similar to wild meat. And we've known for a long time that wild meat is not as harmful when it comes to heart disease, stroke, cancer, and diabetes.
So I don't know if you know this, but I'm also a hunter. And so I go deer hunting every year. And, and I find it to be personally something that goes in line with my cultural heritage of growing up with my father doing this. But also, it's a great source of meat and, you know, is important for controlling some of the population of deer in the forest. It has a different flavor if you're used to only eating beef. But, you know, I love it. My kids do, too.
I only learned to eat venison when I was doing field work in South Georgia when people gave me some. And I really enjoyed learning how to cook it. Yeah, that's great. Well, I was very excited just a year or so ago to discover that a group of scientists from Michigan had come down here to Georgia, and they had measured the full impact of White Oak Pastures beef.
Oh.
They did a full cost accounting of the energy intensity of the beef, looking at all of the parts. You know, is there fertilizer? Is there irrigation, transportation, the cost of butchering? All the parts. And what they found is that not only is White Oak Pastures beef, because it is entirely grass-fed, better than feedlot beef. It's better than feedlot pork. It's better than chicken. It's actually not only zero carbon emissions, but it's negative carbon emissions. So
oh, wow.
That this is a claim that the pasture community has been saying for a long time, that they think the roots of a really well-developed pasture are sequestering more carbon than the animals mm-hmm. are emitting in the various forms that animals emit. And so that has now been confirmed, at least for this one farm.
I think that's fascinating, this idea of being able to apply the economy of energy and really think about what's going into to raising one crop over another.
And, you know, it leaves us, I think, with more choices.
Mm-hmm.
So that for people who are not ready to make a commitment to being vegetarian and they want to eat meat, if you have an option then of eating an ethically based meat that's also healthy for you and good for the planet, you have that option.
That's great.
And I'm sure there are in many parts of the country and around the world some sources of grass-fed meats that people can find.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
And we have at Emory made a commitment that all the ground beef on campus is grass-fed.
Oh, wow. That's I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
That's great.
And we've been able to achieve that goal for a number of years now.
And that's a great support to local farmers.
It is.
Sure. Yeah.
It is, to the tune of a great deal of money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking about, you know, land animals, what about seafood? There's a lot of debate over sustainable seafood use, and what do we know right now about seafood?
Seafood's a place where I think a lot of people are discouraged because they know that the ocean supplies of certain species of fish are declining. And I remember reading a decade or so ago that the sources of fish were in rapid decline. But actually, there's some good news. In the waters of the U.S. and much of Europe, there have been put into play scientific committees that are studying and making recommendations that have teeth, requiring a balance between what is taken out of the water and what the ecosystem can sustain. So we're seeing that some of those scary losses are leveling off and even restoring for some fisheries, for some particular varieties of fish. So I think there's some really good news that we're putting our ecological knowledge to use on the fisheries from the northern part of the U.S., northern part of the Americas and Europe. But unfortunately, in Asia, where a lot of our seafood comes from, those requirements for a scientific assessment of sustainability are not in place.
Mm.
So some of the seafood we get there has both health challenges and sustainability challenges. So what do we do as consumers? Well, one of the things we decided at Emory is that we will just use the Seafood Watch certification. It's online, and its recommendations are developed for each region of the country so that people can easily see whether a particular fish like salmon or trout or catfish or shrimp is recommended for your area. And we have committed at Emory that all the seafood and fish that we serve on campus will be either in the good or best categories. And so we've been able to accomplish that.
That's
too.
Great. So it sounds like a lot of major changes have occurred here as part of the sustainability initiative, and
some very major changes. And we're now able to track that almost 40% of all the food we purchase is either sustainable or local, thanks to our partnership with Bon Appetit.
That's amazing. One other thing I think that strikes people when they come on campus is the plethora of different types of waste bins. And it's funny now when I travel, I'm always like, where's your composting bin? Where's your aluminum and glass?
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that initiative and how that also ties into what's been done with making food choices for delivery at the campus level?
Yes. Well, the Office of Sustainability Initiatives has been very committed to really looking at the issue of waste. And, you know, lots of times when we throw away food, it's just icky garbage. We are glad to get it out of the house. And we don't think about the fact of where does it go.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that it usually, in most cities, goes to an underserved neighborhood where it creates a lot of stink. Mm. It creates vermin, rats, flies, mm-hmm. mosquitoes. Terrible things. There's usually a lot of traffic through those neighborhoods because all those dump trucks are coming from all over the city bringing air pollution. And, of course, the water is often contaminated under the landfill, and it produces methane, which, as we know, is one of the most potent greenhouse gases, 20 times worse than carbon dioxide.
Wow.
So when we throw food away here at Emory, we are actually harming another neighborhood in the city.
Mm.
And we began to take account of that really unacceptable consequence, especially since food waste can be turned into rich fertilizer. All we have to do is apply techniques of composting, which have been known for thousands of years. And so we were very happy when Georgia finally certified the first composting company, and we have a contractor who now comes on campus. And for a while, we just had composting collected from our dining hall. But today, it's wonderful that composting is collected from every building. And so we are able to really reduce hugely. That is one part of it. And then the other part is we've made a commitment to what we call zero waste. And this is true around the country. Zero waste is defined as 95% reduction of landfill. So taking as our baseline where we started a decade or so ago, we are committed to a 95% reduction. And we're now up to about 70% of all the stuff that used to be thrown into the trash is now either recycled or composted.
That's amazing.
It really is a big change. And the Zero Waste campaign at Emory, I was really proud of the vice president who decided that we should go for it because he undertook to make major behavior change.
I was about to ask about this because it's not as simple as just putting out additional containers.
No,
there's a re-education of the entire university community.
And one of the main ways I think we did that, which is one of the tough things, is we took away everybody's trash can. All the staff members who sit at a desk, mm-hmm. used to have a trash can under their desk, and they could throw anything they wanted to in that. The trash cans are all gone.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody now has access, usually at the end of the hall, at the front of the hall, by the bathroom, wherever it's convenient, 5 bins. And so the 5 bins have compost, and they have white paper and mixed paper, and then they have a bin for recyclables, and we have created a single stream of recycling, so we don't have to separate now the cardboard from the metal or from the plastic. And it's amazing to me how I virtually generate nothing that needs to go into the landfill. And I found this at home, too. I've been very fortunate. My neighborhood is served by a compost service where I pay a small fee each month, and once a week they come and take away my bin of garbage. The food waste that I have is mostly cooking scraps, like the tops of turnips or the the core of a cabbage. But this composting service is a real industrial production, so they can even take bones or fat or cheese that's gone moldy. So I can really put everything.
That's great.
And what I've found is that I hardly have anything to put out in the trash. I put out my trash can for pickup once a month or less because there just isn't very much stuff that I have to throw away.
I recently participated in a fermentation workshop here in Atlanta. It was lovely 2-day workshop. And what was interesting to me was also the reduction in food waste with regards to those food scraps, things like cabbage cores and carrot tops, that they would actually lacto-ferment and then use in making food for their pets and for other, so there's a lot of interesting ways to help reduce food waste and add value to what would otherwise, as you said, go into becoming a source of methane in the landfills. So
I think those are great, fun hobbies.
Yeah.
And delicious as well. And I also want to point out, though, that I think there's a lot of attention these days on how individuals waste food. Mm-hmm. And there's a little bit of finger pointing and shaming, when in fact, the majority of the food that we waste, I really think, is beyond our control. Mm-hmm. Just think about it for a minute. What do we really throw away from our apartments and homes? Well, lots of times it's things like the situation I faced this weekend where I wanted to make a soup. I needed 2 stalks of celery, but I needed to buy them at the store where I had to buy 2 heads of celery wrapped in plastic. If I want some cabbage for a slaw, I have to get an enormous head of cabbage, way more usually than I can eat before it goes bad. I have to buy a pint of sour cream, even if I only need a tablespoon or two. Mm-hmm. I don't have the option of getting a half a cup or a cup. And that scaling up of the amount that we have to buy, where if you go to a regular grocery store, they will bundle many little pieces of broccoli into a big bag, really creates a problem for people who have small households and don't eat a big quantity. And some kinds of things can't be saved very long, and so there's not an option to freeze them or something else. Mm-hmm. So I think really we need to begin to work more closely with the food corporations that are packaging these foods. I'm very happy, for instance, that the tofu that I get now is available. It's still a pound package that I have to buy, but it's wrapped in 2 half-pound containers so that I can open one and leave the other to stay fresh. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of packaging will really help. And I think getting rid of packaging and letting us make more choices.
I was about to say, what about bringing in your own containers? I know there's some specialty stores that have moved towards that, but on the larger scale, it doesn't seem to be on the uptick, but that could really be a
Well, a great of course,
way.
The favorite way is through the farmer's market,
that's
where
great, yeah.
I go to the farmer's market. I can get 1 sweet potato if that's what I want. I can get the size cabbage I want. Usually there's a range of sizes. Mm-hmm. And of course, one of the things we know is that a lot of the total food wasted in this country, about half of it is wasted on the farm and in transport from the farm. You can see that. I visited some major carrot farms out in California, and after they're harvested, they're yellow or orange, whatever the color is, in the field because there's so much wasted scraps of carrot that the machinery that harvests them leaves
it's automated
on the ground. Mm. And you see this in the field work that I did in the season of harvesting cotton. The sides of the road are all white, and the fields are white because so much cotton is left. Mm-hmm. And some of the old timers who actually picked cotton by hand in the old days talk about that. While they're happy in some ways that they're not bending over harvesting cotton, they're appalled by the waste. And I think we all should be appalled by the waste. We need to figure out how we can keep that waste from happening. It's crazy that we don't have the kinds of storage structures that would reduce it. And then thinking about how we sell it in a way that's not forcing the consumer to buy more than they really need.
Well, and there are other factors too. There's this pressure towards having the pretty fruits, the perfect vegetables, or uniformity in the produce. Can you talk a bit about that and how that influences food waste?
I really think that was one of those things that is a great example of unintended consequences, because we came out, I believe this all started just before or right after World War II. So we began to standardize our food system. We began to have more grocery stores, and we had rating systems of what's a grade A carrot. Mm-hmm. And certain sizes were standardized. Certain kinds of uniformity was privileged. There's no reason for that, really. Why is it better to have a bundle of carrots all one size than to have a bundle of carrots with mixed sizes? Actually, most of us who go to farmers markets like the mixed. And I love the fact that I get eggs a whole bunch of different sizes when I buy eggs from a farmer, because sometimes I need a small amount and sometimes I need a big
egg.
And so you have that flexibility. But that was ruled out by USDA. And then that forced farmers to have to do things, sometimes with chemicals, to make sure that they are pretty, make sure that the sizes are uniform, and it leaves a lot of waste because all the subsized or too big, too small, not pretty, not perfect shape. Sometimes it can go into a canned product or a soup or something, but sometimes it's just left in the field to rot.
Just left to rot. That's just mind-blowing to me, especially when we're faced with so many people that don't have access to fresh foods.
Right.
Or when they do, again, going back to the education component, they don't perhaps always know how to prepare it. Or we also have, there are a lot of issues, but other issues include, lessons around gardening, how to grow some of your own vegetables, or even culinary herbs that can improve the food, the nutritional quality of our foods. But then you get into also land right issues, and it gets into a whole other area again. But that's very ethical in nature when it comes to how we grow and consume and share our food.
And the way in which Americans all around the country are just growing more of their own food directly, either on their own land or in a community garden, really shows that a lot of people share your point of view on that. They're excited to be able to grow their own food. And I remember meeting this one young man at a university in the Midwest who had led a community garden for the school. And I said, so what motivates you? And he said, things are really crazy in the world right now, and I don't know where we're going to end up. And I like the idea of knowing how to grow my own food. He says, I feel safer knowing how to do that. And other people just love that it tastes so much better.
Yeah, the flavor is very different.
My father would come into the kitchen with some ears of corn that he had grown in the garden, and my parents would eat it within minutes of it being harvested and adore that really fresh corn flavor. And those kinds of treasures, those are real gifts, not only to your stomach and your health, but a gift to the joy in your life.
No, absolutely. I can't agree more. I think one of the great blessings I have in my career is the ability to continue doing my field work in Italy. And when we're there, we stay with my in-laws, and my father-in-law is retired, and he still goes to his small vineyard where he grows local crops, and he has fresh figs. And every morning he goes out early morning, comes back mid-morning with a basket full of all this fresh fruit and vegetables. And I mean, we just gobble it up. It's such a luxury to have that, but that's kind of how it used to be. We've just moved away from that. And I never enjoyed figs until I'd actually had one right off the tree. I was like, wow, these are amazing. It's just the difference
thing.
Is incredible.
And here in Georgia, we used to grow all kinds of cherries and apples, and not just the peaches that we're famous for, but many, many other fruits. And while we may not be able to be the star producer and the largest and most successful in competing with other parts of the country, that doesn't mean we can't enjoy them in our local areas and have varieties, restore varieties, find again the varieties that are going to do well in this climate. And particularly now, as I think we're facing changing climate, finding those old varieties again and treasuring them so that we will find them doing well, perhaps in different locales from where they were originally bred, I think that's going to be an important step for the future.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and this kind of dovetails into my next question, and that's around the point of biodiversity. And how does biodiversity play into this discussion of food waste and ethical eating? And
well, it is really essential on an organic farm to have a very broad and complex ecosystem. You need it for the soil to produce the nutrients for healthy food, and you need it for the sustainability and the stability, really, of the crop. When you have a very reduced ecosystem because you've killed off all sorts of bugs, then it's very easy for pests to take over. And I had a very interesting field trip once to a farmer in South Georgia who was a longtime conventional cotton grower, and he had decided that he really wanted to go organic. And he was working with a University of Georgia insect specialist. And the specialist told us that the farmer had had, at the time that they started the transition, only about 13 types of insects, bugs, microbes in the soil. But after 3 or 4 years of not using any chemicals and trying to build up the soil, he now had 130.
Oh, wow.
So he'd gone from 13 to 130 of the particular categories of bugs that were really helpful. So having that kind of diversity then makes the soil more stable, mm-hmm. and it makes it less likely that diseases can get going. And if pests do come, then there are beneficial insects there who can attack them. So most of the organic farmers that I know around Atlanta produce a multitude of crops, and they are constantly rotating them so that they have a lot of biodiversity on the farm. And they don't worry very much about farm losses. Now, I know that some people have written a lot about, well, organic's all very well, but we can't feed the world with organic.
Mm-hmm.
And I am really delighted that, again, some folks in Michigan, thank heavens for these researchers, have really looked at that, because some of the early studies that suggested that organic agriculture produced a lot less than conventional per acre were based on soils that were relatively newly transitioned to organic. So they hadn't had time to develop the full richness of the biodiverse system and of the soil. So it was true that they were not as productive. So in a more recent study, they only looked at organic farms that had really become well established and had had time to restore their soil. And they looked at the productivity on average of a whole different set of crops. And of course, every year is different and every year produces different amounts. So it's a complicated thing to calculate. But in the end, they calculated that the gap is only 10%, so that the average organic farm is producing 90% of what the average conventional farm is producing.
That's amazing.
Which isn't that much.
Yeah.
And when you think that the conventional farm is benefiting from 100 years of massive research in every state by our colleges of agriculture, the land grant system has been working to up productivity on every crop that's grown in every state. And so we really have really poured in the investments. How much investment have we put into the organic styles of doing things, the non-chemical forms of agriculture? We have a little, but very small compared to the conventional.
Yeah.
So let's give ourselves another 20, 30 years of really intensive investment and see where we are. And the other thing that the research found that I think is so important is that when we talk about feeding the world, they found that organic agriculture, on average, increased the productivity of farms in the global south by 400%.
Wow.
It was much more productive because a lot of those farms can't afford chemical fertilizer and they are too poor to be able to purchase it anyway. They don't have loan programs and sometimes they don't have good supply chains to even get it. So when you go into those areas with a development project that adds organic fertilizer to the soil, they can see a huge increase, which of course really addresses food insecurity because those crops are mainly being consumed by the family. So there's real problem with mixing where these data come from.
Mm-hmm.
Are they coming from the developing world, which has relatively lower production per acre than in some parts of the U.S., although it depends on the crop and it depends on the method. And you could get a real boost. But here in the industrialized countries, it's the 90% number that I think is reassuring to me, because we know in many crops we're producing more than we need. We have surpluses. We have more land in production than we really need. So I don't think we need to worry about famine and starvation. And in fact, because the organic agriculture can be more stable in hard times, as we have very unpredictable weather, I think we will find ourselves being more resilient the more we move away from the chemical-based agriculture.
Yeah, that's interesting. So one of the things that I like to ask on behalf of the audience are, what are some of the ways that we can individually make change in our own, day-to-day routines that will support an environment of sustainability and support this idea of ethical consumption?
Well, that's a great question, and help me out, because I'm sure you have some ideas too. I think one question is to start, how much am I comfortable with? And I think some people say, oh, I'm just not ready to make all those decisions. I don't know as much as I need to know. Well, we can start simply. We can start with a few things. I remember when I began to see organic onions in the store, and I thought, well, I'll just get organic onions. And then there were potatoes, then there were organic canned tomatoes, and I thought, oh, wow, onions, tomatoes. And then there was grass-fed beef, and I thought, and then when the kidney beans were available, okay, now I can make chili, and
that's
it's
great.
All sustainable. So each of those kinds of little decisions, I think, is a contribution. We can also make sure that we're paying attention to what we buy. But I would really like to encourage your listeners to think about how we can influence the institutions that we interact with. If you have connection with a school, many states have a program, as we do here in Georgia, for having local, fresher, and more sustainably produced produce being used in our school lunch programs.
Mm-hmm.
What about if you work in or connected with a hospital or a prison system or a county office or a city-state office? All of those have cafeterias, and
yeah.
We can begin to ask those institutions, how do you make choices around food? And ethical eating, especially when it involves local, really is a legitimate request on the part of a citizen for any public institution. We should all be paying attention to this. We all need to be taking responsibility. And then really push for a policy. We have a policy here at Emory that we're aiming for 75%. We're not going to get there right away, but we have really made a lot of progress, and it's been through a lot of hard work, which came because we got serious.
Yeah.
About living up to our goals. So that has spread around the city, and many of the other educational institutions have adopted goals and made changes. And some of the funding agencies around the city have perked up, said we want to fund this sort of thing, and we see it spreading that way. And I am about ready to sit down with the managers of my local grocery stores and say, really, we are contributing to food waste by this system of packaging. How can we change this?
How can we change it? Yeah.
And so I think as individual citizens, as we have those conversations, and we haven't mentioned yet, unfortunately, the restaurants.
I was about to say, and I've been speaking with, Atlanta is full of some really amazing chefs, and I've seen in conversations with them that more and more of our restaurants are moving towards composting some of their scraps from the kitchen, and that's a huge step forward.
It's a huge step forward.
Yeah.
And also really reducing portion sizes so that we have a reasonable amount on our plates. The sort of competition for who can provide more food to throw away is really a competition we have to stop.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. That's a great point. Well, thank you so much, Peggy, for coming on the show. This has been enlightening. And I just want to say how proud I am of being a member of an institution that's put so much effort into ensuring that we have an ethical and sustainable system in which to work with, providing food that's healthy and sustainable to our students and to our employees here.
So. Well, thank you. And really, a lot of credit goes to a lot of hard work in our dining, in our hospital dining. And I appreciate the partnerships we've had across the university.
Great. Thank you. I'm Dr. Cassandra Quave, and you've been listening to Foodie Pharmacology, the science podcast for the food curious, recorded in Atlanta, Georgia, at the Emory University Center for Digital Scholarship. We've got a new website with some fun extra info for each episode to share with you, so check it out at www.foodiepharmacology.com. Be sure you don't ever miss any future shows. You can subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or basically any other major podcast streaming platform. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.